Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome into the Computer America Show. We are the nation's longest running, nationally syndicated radio talk show on computers and technology. Thank you for joining us. I'm your host, Ben Crossman, and I hope all of you are having a fantastic day. And hey, it's Friday, so it can't be too bad as we head into the weekend. But before we do, we have one more episode of Computer America for you, where today we will be focusing on computer and technology news for the entire hour. So this will be everything that we didn't get to cover yesterday. We spent a lot of time talking with our guest from Lucid, and you know that was a great interview. Loved it. But hey, I think this last last day of the week, we're really going to focus on getting a lot of the Samsung news out of the way, as well as some other fun tidbits that we have for you. So, but before we get started, a couple of things, including ComputerAmerica.com. That's where you'll find everything from the show notes, any links, videos, stories, articles, anything like that will be found in one place right there on our homepage. Also, while you're there, be sure to check out the social media contest brought to you by Logitech. And on top of that, be sure to check out the live video stream, which is brought to you by OWC. And you can also find that at twitch.tv/computeramerica. If you feel like heading over to the chat room and you can make it here 4 p.m. to 5 p.m. Eastern, then we are there live taking your questions, comments, concerns, and ignoring most of them. So there you go. But hey, like I said, I hope everyone out there is having a great Friday, and we of course are going to get started here. So again, for the entire show, computer and technology news brought to you by OWC. Here we go. All right, so I think for our first story that we're going to do, let's actually tackle this head first and really try to get into everything that we know happened with Samsung. Because, so if you didn't know, I believe it was called like the Unpacked event, whatever the heck they call it. But essentially, it was one big event to show what Samsung is up to. And that includes everything from the phone. We were right in the middle of the phone when we had to interrupt it and get to our guests. But that includes everything from a phone to a smart speaker, think Google Home or Amazon Echo type device, and some smartwatches and more. So we're going to go ahead, tackle that, try to get that out of the way here pretty quick. But hey, they showed off some pretty cool stuff over there at Samsung, you know, just stuff that you... Again, kind of as you said earlier, Samsung plays at the top end of the spectrum as far as it goes with phones and other devices. They are one of the most expensive in the consumer electronics world, and that means that they're, you know, hey, technology is a pretty linear scale. You know, it's not like someone is explicitly overcharging you or, you know, kind of going, the more money you can put into a piece of technology, in a lot of cases, the better that technology is. I'm not saying that there aren't deals. I'm not saying that it's not possible to get a good bargain. I'm saying that a $100 webcam is going to be much, very inferior to, let's say, a $1,000 camera. It's just the way technology is. You get what you pay for in a lot of cases. So that's why we really enjoy talking about Samsung, is because, again, hey, they play at the top. So... all right, so let's see. Let's go ahead and talk about, and I think this was the last one. So we have four stories, and they all revolved around Samsung. Let's go ahead and get into these. So the first one, we're going to pick up where we left off yesterday, and that would be the phones. So the Samsung Galaxy Note 9. This is their biggest of the big when it comes to... So this is the biggest of the big when it comes to their smartphones, and this thing's massive. So again, some of the specs, 4,000 milliamp battery, which means that it's a bit longer battery life than many of the phones out there. Many of the phones that you know and love have anywhere from a 2,500 to a 3,500 milliamp battery. This thing is able to sport a 4,000. So you know, maybe an hour or two over its competitors. Resolution 3000 by 1400, not too bad, much better than 1080p. So you're not going to be, you know, kind of worried about screen real estate there. Let's see, you're also looking at 128 gigs of storage, which can go up to 500 gigs, as well as another 500 from a micro SD card slot, which means this one phone, this one device, can store up to 1 terabyte of data. Very, very good for working professionals or just someone who has maybe a lot of music and you don't want to part from it. Or, you know, a trend that a lot of people are doing, they are downloading their Netflix, Hulu, Amazon Video, whatever. They're downloading it so that they can then take it on the planes. So, yeah, if storage is a priority for you, then this is probably one of the biggest phones that we've seen that can do that. Let's see. They also get into the performance, where the Note 9 will include a 10-nanometer processor, which they say will either be the Snapdragon 845 or the Samsung Exynos, chip, which Samsung Exynos chip, depending on where you live. So Snapdragon, you know, as much as we talk about Intel and AMD here on the show, as far as processors go, Snapdragon, there's a reason Snapdragon is like the second biggest processor in the world, or even maybe in a lot of cases the first, because yeah, Snapdragon's just in everything. So that doesn't surprise me one bit, but that is one of their higher quality Snapdragon device or processors. So very, very cool there. They also say it comes with a water carbon cooling system. I don't know what a water carbon cooling system is. And AI performance tuning to help keep the speeds up for games and other high intensity tasks. And finally, the Samsung is joining the ranks of Android vendors offering 6 gigs of RAM with a phone. Many people's computers don't support 6 gigs of RAM. I mean, it's for a desktop computer, that's really not a big deal. Yeah, that's pretty cheap, but for a phone, very impressive. They said that you'll only get the 6 gigs in the 128, whereas the 512 model packs 8 gigs of RAM for heavy multitasking. This thing's going to be a beast. But one more point we should touch on here, and here's the problem. It's a beast of a phone. There's no way around it. This thing is borderline one of the best tablets you can probably buy on the market. Because, again, it sports a 6.4-inch screen, which is, you know, quite bulky. And for a phone, the specs are really, really good. The problem comes to the fact that, and I've seen it in, you know, in our chat room here, I've seen it, you know, voiced by a couple other people. When you think phone, I think a lot of people are still stuck in the, you know, the iPhone 5S, the Samsung Galaxy Note 7, kind of mindset, thinking that a phone at most should run you like $800, you know, $750, $800. And that's like for people who really like their phones. Well, the Samsung Galaxy Note 9, they have thrown out the rule book. They've said, you know what, we're going to give you the best phone that you can possibly get. And on paper, so far, it looks like they've done just that. But speaking of paper, you'll have to cough up a lot of it. Because the price where a contract-free phone, and you really want to emphasize the contract-free part, because any contract that you get yourself into, you know, be it through any of the major carriers here in the United States, you're going to be paying more than that. There's no one out there who is going to give you a phone for less than sticker price. So the contract-free price is going to be $1,000 for the base phone. $1,000. That is a high-end laptop, that's a mid-range laptop to a high-end computer to now this phone. $1,000 for the base phone, which can jump up to $1,250 for the 512, which has, you know, higher RAM, more storage, a couple other perks. And, you know, $1,250. Now, a lot of people look at that number and they say, this is the obvious, you know, kind of evolution of smartphones. We're asking more of them. We are demanding more of them. And we are doing more on our phones. So where you would think maybe a couple of years ago, you know, paying over $1,000 for a phone would be unconscionable. That'd be, you know, we joked about a $10,000 phone that was covered in gold and diamonds and things like that. And it was, you know, it was a lot of fun to joke about these expensive phones. But now we look at them and go, you know, some people could probably justify the cost. It's not just an exercise in, you know, burning money, but it's an exercise in, I use my phone 6 hours a day, either, you know, doing other kind of tasks, using it for productivity, or any number of, you know, different things. Maybe $1,250 is okay. But there's probably the vast majority out there who are going to say $1,250, way too much. That's too much for a phone. We're not going to pay that much. That's it. And then there's the third camp, which is, wait, phones cost that much? I never knew. I just pay $80 a month for 24 months. I had no idea that phones were so expensive. Because, what is it? I think it's like 90% of all phones are purchased through some kind of payment plan contract through one of the four major providers here in the United States. No one really buys their phone outright. That's more of an overseas thing and just not an American thing. But people are still paying that price. It's just, you know, kind of spread out over 2 years, and then they feel kind of justified. They feel it's okay. I don't know what else to say other than this is a really good phone. Again, on paper, this has probably some of the best specs I've ever seen on a phone, and it's awesome. But the price is exorbitant. It is crazy. And by the way, they're also offering some launch day perks, including some Fortnite bucks. We have another Fortnite story. Fortnite has taken this world by storm. And they're also giving you some noise-canceling headphones if you pre-purchase early. But all in all, Samsung Galaxy Note 9, the most expensive phone from Apple or Samsung that we've ever seen. And yeah, it's pretty crazy. So there's that one. And then there is, let me see if we can pull this one up. So again, we're going to try to get through all the Samsung real quick. The next one, it didn't make some sense to a lot of people, but hey, I guess they don't have to when you are talking about things that make sense. So now we're going to talk about the Galaxy Home. This is Samsung's answer to Amazon Alexa or Google Home or even Apple Siri to a lesser extent, or even to a lesser extent to that. Microsoft Cortana. Bixby has long been one of the furthest behind when it comes to digital assistants. Their digital assistant, as far as English speaking goes, as I understand it, well, it just had trouble understanding English speakers. It spoke Korean very well. It was able to do things in Korean apps very well. But as far as being an American-centric device, or, you know, just something that could compete in the American market, it was woefully behind. So if you're watching the video portion, you're going to see this big thing that a lot of people have described as, well, I've seen some people call it a grill. For cooking, it's big, it's bulbousy, it has these three little legs that come off of it, kind of cute in its own way, but also I think it's trying very hard to be different in a field where there's just not that much you can do to differentiate yourself. So I digress. The Galaxy Home. Samsung has been developing a speaker. And by the way, this is an article from Engadget. Engadget did great, great, great work covering the whole event yesterday. So this one from Engadget, Edgar Alvarez, talking about how Samsung has been developing a speaker based on its own digital assistant, Bixby, for a while. And today, we're getting our first look, today being yesterday, saying that during the company's Galaxy Note 9 event, they said that Samsung finally revealed the Galaxy Home smart speaker, a clear rival to the Apple HomePod, the Google Home, and the Amazon Echo line. So they said that the device, which features the rumored tripod design with a round body, yes, tripod legs, and it definitely has curves, just I don't think in the right place. But they said that it's powered by Harman's AKG audio and was engineered to make music sound amazing. You know what? I think a lot of speakers are engineered to make stuff sound good, but what do I know? Of course, this is a smart speaker after all, and you'll be able to use your voice to control it. Samsung says that there are 8 microphones built in for far-field voice recognition. So that kind of implies that it's going to be able to hear you very clearly, regardless of how far away you're trying, in a room, you are trying to talk to it. And yeah, they said that if you say things like, I doubt that anyone has this thing because first of all, it's not even made yet. But if you say things like Bixby Sound Steer, and the Galaxy Home will calibrate its audio and direct it at you. In the future, through a new partnership between Samsung and Spotify, you'll have the ability to play music from the streaming service on the home. So again, this thing is called Galaxy Home. So we have Google Home, Galaxy Home, and don't get the two confused. So there's no pricing, no details of availability, but it was one of the first time that we were able to see the device. They will be coming out with it, and all in all, Bixby has never really been a true competitor. It has a long way to go as far as development goes, and admittedly, anything Samsung does, Samsung is not a small player in this field, but they're just not a competitive one. So, yeah, they have a lot of development to do. So, all right, there's that one. 2 more to go for Samsung, to catch you up on what happened at the event on Thursday in New York. And by the way, the third story we're actually going to skip because I'm, kind of digging further into it. And essentially, it's picking on the Bixby. As I said before, it's not, it's not exactly viable. So let's just go ahead and skip over to the last one. And this one's pretty cool. I think this one actually has a lot of promise as far as what was announced by Samsung. And, this is something that a lot of smartwatches, kind of miss, is that a lot of smartwatches, they try to be watches that look like little computers strapped to your wrist, as opposed to, some of the obvious ground to cover there, is that some people just want a smartwatch that looks like a watch, but has all the, features of a computer. So let's get into this. Again, if you're watching the video portion, you can see them here. They look like really nice watches. They look like really high-end watches. They do not look like the Apple Watch. They do not look like the Pebble or anything like that. They look like really nice watches. So this is the Samsung Galaxy Watch. It's taking the same branding as the Galaxy line of phones, and it looks like a real watch, obviously. So they said that it's not a surprise that the company announced the Galaxy Watch at its event today, saying that it will come in 2 sizes, which include a 42-millimeter, which will be priced at about $330, versus a 46-millimeter, which will be $350. So $20 more gets you 4 more millimeters. Okay? I know a lot of people that would do that. So they said that the 46-millimeter watch will come in silver, while the 42 will come in midnight and midnight black and rose gold. So silver, black, gold, take your choice. And you can start pre-ordering here, I think it said today. So they said that the Galaxy Watch looks like an actual watch, not a smartwatch, complete with a circular bezel and rotating design. And many of the features are similar to the previous Samsung smartwatches. And they have LTE connectivity and a battery that will last several days. And then you have to start winding it. I'm kidding. It's not a wind-up watch. It's it's just a nice watch. So they said that, part of it is thanks to a processor that was created specifically for smartwatches. And of course, the LTE connection allows you to answer calls, respond to text, stream music, and more. Again, all through the watch. So they said that the Galaxy Watch will offer faces aimed at productivity. A daily briefing feature will certainly help those there, as the watch can sync with your calendar and show you your appointments on the home screen. You can purchase a variety of bands, and there will be over about 60,000 faces for the watch. So if you don't like one, you can go out to the quote-unquote app store and get a new face for your phone. A new face for your smartwatch. The watch also has a 5 ATM water resistance. So, like, a 5 isn't wear it in the shower or whatever. Like, a 5 is like, it can get wet, but you're going to want to dry it off. Like, I think a 5 rating is like, it's like splash resistant, which is okay. A 6 is like up to 3 feet of water submerged for like 5 minutes. And then like a 7 rating, as far as water goes, is like up to, 300 feet. So it's splash resistant as far as smartwatches go. So, of course, the watch also has fitness and health tracking. It has connected health features, including stress management, which will track your heart rate and offer suggestions if it thinks you need to de-stress. I do like the idea that your watch would be like, Ben, you are getting far too worked up. You need to sit down and meditate for 5 minutes. Watches orders. I like that. So in addition to Samsung Health, there's access to Samsung Pay, Bixby, and SmartThings so that you can keep tabs on all the things Samsung has right on your wrist. So there's that one. As much as I don't like Bixby, and as much as I don't like the Bixby smart speaker, I think that their smartwatch really hit the mark. For a long time, even though the smartwatch category has been not seeing as much growth as I think even the smartwatch companies would have liked, the Samsung products have always been a strong competitor in that field. And this just goes to show why they will continue to be as such. Because where Apple is trying to make it very apparent that you are wearing an Apple device, which, let's face it, Apple is the saddest thing. This one just looks like a really nice watch that also has connected features to it, which is a really good idea. So, all right, there you go. There's that one. Again, all of these stories were just catch up from yesterday for Samsung's event, and happy that we could do them. So, all right, let's go ahead. Let's see if there's anything else from yesterday that we really wanted to mention. And how about this one? All right, two stories, and then we'll move on to today's stories. And let's see. I think we can talk about this one real quick. So this one isn't exactly consumer-facing, but it is pretty darn cool. So when we talk about storage and memory, for everyone out there who's kind of new around here, when you talk about memory in a computer or any kind of system, you're talking about RAM, random access memory. And, that can be measured in 8, 16, 32, 64, 128 gigabytes of RAM or gigs of RAM. You'll hear that thrown around a lot, and that is memory. The other side is called storage. And some people sometimes call it memory as well, but they mean storage, and that's the amount of data you can store on one drive, be it an SSD, HDD, or, a solid-state drive or a traditional hard drive. And in a lot of cases, those were denoted by how much they could store based on gigabytes. So a lot of solid-state drives, they're just now getting to the point to where we are talking about like a 1 terabyte SSD or a 4 terabyte SSD. We just had an interview with one of our sponsors, OWC, where they were pushing or at least they were just making available their 4 terabyte SSD. And they have like 30 terabyte traditional hard drives. So in a lot of cases, the reason that I'm saying this in concerns to the story is that a lot of the storage that we hear about is measured in terabytes. So that's 1,000 gigs. That's a lot of storage. Even by today's standards, terabytes is a good unit of measurement. Now, here's why I mention all this. This from The Verge, Intel. You know them? They do stuff. Intel's new ruler, they call it that because if you look at the if you look at the image of it, it looks like a ruler, a really long ruler, and inches and centimeters and whatnot. Yeah, you got it. So they said that the new ruler SSD could pack 1 petabyte of data in a single server rack. So a server rack is another thing that we don't really talk about here because that's not really consumer facing, but a server rack are these, maybe you've seen like behind the scenes at Google or things like that. They're the big, kind of caves looking things, finished in black. And these things are there to store massive amounts of data so that Amazon Web Services and, Microsoft Azure can do what they do. Well, you want to squeeze as much memory as you can that is as effective as it can be and as fast as it can be. Because if you have more storage and it works faster, more efficiently, and it doesn't generate as much heat, the better your bottom line is. And this is where a lot of money is being made, so there's a lot of effort to see who can have the best of the best when it comes to this area. Intel is rolling out their new SSD, which can have 1 petabyte in a single rack, which is amazing. This is the first time I've heard of something like this. So the hard drives and the SSDs come in pretty standard shapes at this point. There's the 3.5-inch drive for desktops, the 2.5-inch for laptops, and the new M.2 standard that basically looks like a giant stick of RAM. Well, Intel's new enterprise SSDs are changing that with the company's new Ruler design, which is designed to optimize storage density while also reducing the amount of power and cooling, and this is by TechGage. So by having this design, instead of having a cube where you limit your surface area, this allows as much surface area as possible so that it can cool itself just better. So again, efficiency goes up. Cooling is always a problem when it comes to storage. And yeah, this thing's a beast. So the new drive with their slimmed down shapes are designed for server racks where Intel says they'll be able to massively increase the amount of storage on hand. And while the company isn't offering much in the way of information or how big each one will be, Intel claims that the company will be able to reach 1 petabyte or 1,000 terabytes, or 1 million gigabytes worth of storage in a single one U server rack, which is the smallest size rack available. And in comparison, the traditional 10 terabyte 3.5-inch hard drives would require a dramatically larger 4U rack with a similar increased power supply and cooling cost. So it's unlikely that we'll see any super long, skinny desktops in our future, but this is just another cool way that Intel is trying to, meet demand. And it's just different form factor, and I thought it was pretty darn cool. So check that out. Again, not exactly consumer facing, but it's different. It's different, all right. All right, so there's that one, and then the music starts. So everyone, the music playing in the background means that we are about to go off to break. And when we come back, we're going to get into some of today's news where we talk about things such as Apple and the Apple Car. We're going to talk about Google and the Fortnite debacle, or if it even is that, and more. So everyone, more computer technology news when we come back. Computer America, stay tuned. And welcome back to the Computer America Show, 32 minutes past the hour as we continue on here. And by the way, why don't we go ahead and before we get into our technology news again, let's draw a winner from a contest. So for those of you who are new, every single week we give away a prize to one lucky listener who has taken the time, energy, effort to enter our contest, which you can find at the homepage at Computer America. So this week's winner is, we have something for this before we get started. There we go. So Computer America Social Media Contest, brought to you by Logitech, is a very easy way to enter to win an M720 triathlon mouse from the company. And this week's winner is the one, the only. Oh, wow. Ooh, wow, I did that. There we go. So I just said all that stuff and no one even heard me. That's okay. This week's winner for our social media contest is, and that's brought to you by Logitech, is Miss Anita Mitchell. All right, so Anita Mitchell listens to us in Seneca, Missouri, United States. So, Seneca, Missouri, and all she had to do was, so there's 13 different entries you can have, 8 different ways that you can enter, and one of the ways that you can enter the social media contest is by referring a friend. Oh, I take it back. We've had one other person who referred a friend, and this person also referred a friend, and they just won. So here we go. This week's winner is Anita Mitchell, and we have her information. We're going to get in touch with her, and it's just that easy. So if you want to be next week's Anita, then all you have to do is go to computeramerica.com and enter the contest. We could be calling your name live on the air to give you a prize. So just that simple, just that cool. So let's go ahead and continue on. So, everyone, if you missed any part of today's show, we are doing computer and technology news. And if you want to catch up on it, podcast, wherever podcasts are heard, that is where you want to be. Because Computer America can be heard on iTunes, Google Play, iHeartRadio, Spotify, SoundCloud, Spreaker, Blog Talk Radio, and more. Or if you're listening to us live on IRN, we appreciate that too. So, let's go ahead and continue on with computer and technology news. Let's talk about today's news and a lot of really interesting things and things that we should probably talk about. The first one is, we covered this more when net neutrality was still a thing. It is not anymore. There are a couple of states that are putting legislation into their state-level government that are very similar to net neutrality. But we had a federal net neutrality program policy that was removed. And if you recall, during our coverage of that, one of the biggest things was a proposed DDoS attack. It was DDoS standing for a distributed denial of service attack. That's when a massive number of robots or automated controlled computers go out and disrupt a website through bogus traffic or any number or any kind of request for information. Essentially, it's a way for a massive or a single individual to disrupt the service of a website. And the FCC claimed they were being DDoSed. So they were justified during this whole debate over net neutrality. They were justified in blocking a lot of traffic. They were justified in taking down their form for comments and so much more. Now, a lot of people who had been following what was going on with this, with net neutrality, with Ajit Pai, with, this supposed DDoS attack, they claimed it, but there's a very simple way that you can prove you were under a DDoS attack. And many companies out there, they are more than willing to share this information because there's really nothing identifiable about the company by releasing it. They just show traffic logs. They can, you can see regular traffic, and then you can see a massive spike and then a massive crash as your service collapses under the strain. So a lot of companies are more than willing to release that information just to show what was happening. The FCC did nothing of the sort. They came out, they claimed, and by the way, here's actually the exact quote saying, beginning on Sunday night at midnight, our analysis reveals that the FCC was subject to multiple distributed denial of service attacks, and that these were deliberate attempts by external actors to bombard the FCC's comment system with a high amount of traffic to our commercial cloud host. These actors were not attempting to file comment themselves. Rather, they made it difficult for legitimate commenters to access and file with the FCC. So, again, a number of security experts, they really did claim that it was very suspect because it had none of the usual telltale signs of an actual DDoS attack. And they said that they discovered the analysis the FCC supposedly conducted never actually took place. And when the media outlets began reporting that the FCC had zero evidence to support the DDoS claim, the FCC issued a punchy statement to multiple outlets accusing Gizmodo of being completely irresponsible. So they said that the FCC has never stated that it lacks any documentation of the DDoS attack itself, and news reports claiming that the commission has said that this are without any basis and completely irresponsible. And they underlined this one. In fact, we have a lot of documentation of this attack in the form of logs collected by our commercial cloud partners. So those logs, like I said, very easily accessed, very easy to publish. Again, not a lot of the FCC is not one of those companies that really needs to keep their, or not one of those organizations that needs to keep their logs a secret. But they refuse to publish any of them. And then they come out with statements saying, we were DDoSed, how dare you question us? We have a lot of documentation. This definitely happened. Well, eventually, through FOIA requests, so the Freedom of Information Act request, they made it clear that the FCC CIO either made up the DDoS attack or misinterpreted legitimate Oliver viewer traffic. So Oliver, they're talking about John Oliver from Last Week Tonight or whatever show he has, as a malicious act. But those emails also make clear that PI's FCC then pushed the DDoS attack narrative to numerous tech reporters, apparently in a bid to try and downplay the public's massive opposition to the policies. So they said that this act was only compounded by the FCC's refusal to seriously address the identity theft and fraud that polluted the repeal's comment period. The only real-time consumer had to voice their opinion. So essentially, why this matters? This matters because when there was the period for open comments, the FCC used the massive amount of traffic that was going to their site for voicing their opposition to this request. They were able to completely write off, saying, look at all this traffic, look at all this interest, and trust me, it was orders of magnitude greater than any other topic that is proposed by the FCC, the FCC. They looked at all that traffic and said, this doesn't matter. This is happening through malicious means. This is not real. Don't look at this. It doesn't matter. And then when there was an actual legitimate problem, which was people were having their identity stolen and voicing their opinions, quote unquote, that were very cookie cutter, used the same language, and used people's identities without their knowledge, including their home address, their first and last name, which is really kind of all you needed to file a report. They looked at those and said, that's okay, fraud wasn't really an issue. Keep in mind, a couple of the people whose identities were stolen include none other than Barack Obama, former president of the United States, using his Washington, D.C. White House address to say that he was against the legislation that he put in place to make the whole thing possible. There was some very obvious and easily proven fraud going on, but they said, all right, so the conversation is split for and against, except there's a lot of people who are against repealing net neutrality. That's all fake traffic. And then look at all these reports about people who are for repealing it, and don't worry that they're fake identities. So between those two, it took the conversation from here are the facts, here's what people want, to we don't know what the people want, there's too much noise in the system. And that's how the FCC was able to justify itself in saying, hey, we need to repeal this because this is what our constituents want, which by a lot of people was not the case. So they said that by hoping to get ahead of the pretty damning investigation, Ajit Pai issued a statement before the report was released, throwing everybody but himself under the bus for the DDoS attack that wasn't. And this is a quote that just happened, today, saying, quote, "I am deeply disappointed that the FCC's former chief information officer, who was hired by the prior administration and is no longer with the commission, provided inaccurate information about the incident to me, my office, Congress, and the American people. This is completely unacceptable. I am also disappointed that some working under the former CIO apparently either disagreed with the information that was that he was presenting or had questions about it, yet didn't feel comfortable communicating their concerns to me or my office." So Ajit Pai, the chairman of the FCC, essentially saying that, hey, my people did not give me the right information, and the people who were supposed to tell me this was not the right information chickened out. The buck does not stop at Ajit Pai's desk, apparently. So there you go. I think we're going to stop this whole thing here. You know, there's some more that goes into the report and, you know, just essentially – this whole net neutrality repeal was done in bad faith, but there's not a lot of precedent that shows that you can go back and reverse this decision after they voted on it and it's already been repealed. So, yeah, net neutrality, while it's not dead, again, fights continue to happen at the state level. It's just such bad and poor. Arguing in bad faith with the FCC was such a headache then and now. So there you go. All right. There's that one. FCC, they are a bunch of clowns. Let's go ahead and talk about something a little bit more uplifting. Do we have something more uplifting? The show's almost over and it's Friday. Let's try to get happy. Happy. Wow, not a lot of happy. All right, how about this one? You folks, you may know Shakespeare. He's written a play or two. And hey, maybe you had to read some of his work in high school and then appreciate it because, you know, a couple hundred years, people haven't appreciated enough of his work, apparently. Well, here we have it. This is from Engadget, talking about AI, artificial intelligence, machine learning. Researchers were able to teach a computer to compose sonnets like Shakespeare. And this by Andrew Tarantola and Engadget, talking about, in addition to penning 37 plays, Shakespeare was a prolific composer of sonnets, where he crafted about 154 of them during his life. And now, more than 400 years after his death, the Bard's words are influencing a new generation of poets. However, they will be done with silicon imagination and digital quills. Essentially, in collaboration with the University of Toronto, the University of Melbourne, and IBM's Australia division, they have managed to teach a neural network to craft sonnets just as Shakespeare did in the 16th century, using his own words to teach the machine. And they published their results at the 2018 ACL conference, and now you can play around with the network yourself at GitHub. So let's see, sonnets follow a specific structure and rhyming pattern. If you don't know, each is composed of 14 lines, three quatrains, followed by a couplet, for example, and they even include an example of Shakespeare there. You can enjoy that. I am terrible at reading Shakespeare. I would say that I have this high school teacher who was so good at reading Shakespeare, other English teachers would invite them to their classrooms on his lunch break so that he could read Shakespeare for the students. I remember it because he was so good, because he would get into it. He would, he would really, it was like watching a play as someone read the sonnet. And he would spit on the kids in the front row. He would, throw his arms out. And, you could hear him from across the building. It was a lot of fun. He read it very, very well. And it was in that moment I realized I could never do that. I could never read Shakespeare like that. So I'm not even going to try, unfortunately, for all of you. But I digress. They said that we are interested in understanding whether these forms can be learned automatically from data, and without relying on external knowledge sources, such as syllable or pronunciation dictionaries. So essentially, they fed in all of Shakespeare's work, and they didn't tell it anything else. They just said, make what you are learning. And they said they said that the combined total of 2,600 examples is actually a rather small data set for training a neural network, saying that the scale in the order of thousands of sonnets is actually tiny compared to a typical training data that deep learning systems take, which we've seen before. Deep learning, as we know, deep learning, machine learning, AI, whatever. Generally, you want millions of data points, not thousands. So at any rate, he said that we had to be fairly creative when designing the network. We can't have an overly complex network, as it will simply memorize the sonnets. The key is that we want the network to generalize its learnings so that it can compose new poems. And here's one of the shortened examples. And again, remember, this is an example created completely and wholly by the machine, saying that so gently as the wind that flaps his wings and shoots a monarch on the English lays, and what was that? With matters of all things, 'tis well ashamed to know of all her ways. Now, we're not going to have English appreciation. We're not going to pick apart this thing, but it is important to know. Wings and things, lays and ways, it was able to make its own quatrain all by itself without knowing anything about the English language, without knowing anything about, any of the, what exactly a sonnet is. It was able to make a part of a sonnet, and I'm sure, it made the entirety of a sonnet. So because the system understands the whys in addition to the hows of sonnet creation, it can, in theory, be adapted to generate them in any language. So we're going to go ahead and, kind of switch over, but I thought that was pretty cool. Teaching, we all thought that arts was one of those fields that was going to be artificial intelligence proof, that it was going to be automation proof. How do you teach a computer to, to wax poetic? How do you teach a computer to appreciate a sunset and put that on a canvas? How do you teach a computer to understand the emotion of love and, make a song out of it? And we all thought that that was something where humans, that's the job humans were going to do. When, lift that box or dig that hole, we're going to be completely automated by machine. But we're quickly learning that you can indeed teach a computer what is so special about anything, and it can then create art by itself. And, of course, the art will simply be, none of it will have extreme leaps in creativity, like I'm sure humans are prone to do. But at the same time, if you are looking for something similar to what's already out there and that's already good, it can then evolve, you know, kind of upon that. And it can make great paintings, it can make great music, it can make sonnets now. That's something that computers are only going to get better and better at. So art, not as automation-proof as we first thought. There you go. Okay, let's talk about this one. Because this is one of the stories that pops up every couple of months, and at this point, I'm just ready to see anything come to fruition about this. So, Apple, you may know them. They're worth $1 trillion. They, turns out, looks like they might just be building a car after all, as it rehires an ex-Tesla engineer head. So, if you're looking for hints that Apple might deliver on its long-rumored plan to develop its own car, a significant one landed this week after it emerged that Doug Field, who is Apple's former VP of Mac hardware engineering, has rejoined the company after a spell with Tesla. Which isn't too uncommon. You know, some of these higher-ups, some of these people with very important jobs, there's a lot of there's a lot of cross-pollination between the likes of Apple, Microsoft, Google, Tesla, a lot of these big tech companies really do share the same small pool of talent at the very tippy top. So John Gruber at Daring Fireball broke the news of Field returning to Apple following 5 years at Tesla, where he oversaw the production of the Model 3. And Apple confirmed in a statement that TechCrunch that it had rehired Field, but it declined to give information about his role. And they said that Field will link up with Bob Mansfield, the former colleague he worked with on the Mac hardware business, and Mansfield just so happened to be the person who was heading up Apple's Project Titan car project. So, a couple projects in there. But yeah, having been tempted back and out of retirement, so there's a lot to dig into. There's been plenty of speculation about the secretive Project Titan, most notably that it was reported in 2016 that Apple had abandoned plans to develop a car. Instead, it was said to be focused on autonomous driving technology, and while the project remains pretty opaque and tough to gauge, the hiring of the man who oversaw the production of the Tesla cars, it's a pretty interesting clue that suggests Apple might be reviving plans to develop a car once again. And, you know, it's... I wouldn't even go so far to say that Apple was probably developing their own car. I think that is just something Apple's not really into. Developing an entire car, admittedly, it's something that they could probably pull the resources together for. They would probably get people interested. But at the same time, I think that by rehiring someone who has been with the company before, hey, there's a lot of interest in that because he knows the culture at Apple, so no kind of acclimating there. And then he's worked with cars, so to me, it's still the self-driving technology around Apple that they're hoping to push. But by bringing back someone who has worked, kind of hands-on in the car field, I think that they're still doing the automation. They're not going to develop a car, but at least they have someone who is going to be able to look at a car and say, this is where our shortcomings are, because at Tesla, we tried this, and it didn't work how we wanted it to, so we have to do it this way. Apple is probably developing the technology for self-driving cars, but I doubt you will see an Apple-branded car anytime, really, ever. So, yeah, it was still an interesting story because it's, again, one of the stories that Apple and cars, you don't really think about them mixing and matching, but then over the past couple of years, you've been hearing exactly that Apple is looking to get into the car business. So, anyways, I think that's how we go. All right, last one before we head off into the weekend. And again, thank you everyone for joining us here on Computer America. Let's finish off with some interesting news from Google, or I guess bad news from Google, involving this thing that we mentioned Tuesday on our Gamer Tuesday, and that is Fortnite is avoiding the Google Play Store. So the Google Play, it's that's the app store that if you have any kind of Android phone, that's what you get your applications from. Well, the Fortnite has chosen to bypass the Google App Store altogether and instead will be distributing their software on mobile phones through their own website. And they said that Fortnite has grossed about $180 million on iOS devices and where it has been exclusively available since its launch, since the launch of its invite-only beta in March 15th. So in just a couple of months, it's made $180 million. And when it comes to Android, Google will stand to, and I don't even like hearing the word lose, or even it will cost Google $50 million. It's just that Google will not get their 30% cut, which means that they won't get their $50 million from Fortnite pushing this to Android devices. Again, I don't think this costs Google anything. They don't lose anything. It's just that they don't get the money. Very important difference, and really just goes to show just how big Fortnite has become. So there you go. With that being said, everyone, with that being said, everyone, the music means that we're just about done here. Thank you for joining us here on Computer America. Hopefully you had a good time. I certainly did. And one final reminder, Computer America will not be on the air Monday or Tuesday of next week, but we will be back Wednesday with a brand new show, and looking forward to it. So everyone out there, have a great weekend. Catch you here next week. And in the meantime, do something fun, go see a movie, or just relax. So everyone, have a great one. Bye-bye.